We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, I'm joined by Freedom Foundation CEO, Aaron Wythe. Aaron, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Emily.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot to talk about, particularly in the arena that you work in. I want to start with your recent argument against Randy Weingarten, America's sweetheart, Randy Weingarten, who's, of course, president of the American Federation of Teachers. So the union that's been really a sort of put on a masterclass in flip-flopping on school closures and has been at the forefront of a lot of the most ridiculous talking points that hurt children over the course of the last 2 years, their learning and development. So Aaron, tell us about your recent sort of comments on Weingarten. It's sort of hard to keep up with how ridiculous she is, but just in recently, at the very least, what did you have to say about her hypocrisy?
Yeah, I mean, I laugh about it, but what she's done is devastated at children. I mean, Randy Weingarten is the head of the Teachers Union, the American Federation of Teachers. And basically for the past 2 years, she's been advocating for keeping kids out of schools, remote learning, and of course, making our kids wear face masks in schools. And across states and cities where the teachers unions have been able to put into office their candidates, people that they have funded and endorsed. We've seen that play out. I mean, they've had the power to go and stop kids actually going into school, force them to stay at home, force them to do remote learning, and force them to wear masks. And it's totally devastated. And we'll go into that a little bit later. It's totally devastated our children. But I have a quote. My favorite quote on this is from Moms for Liberty. And they said that Randy Weingarten is an arsonist now pretending to be a firefighter because she has completely flip-flopped her stance now that she's seen polling and data that says what we knew from the start, which is that kids never should have been kept at home. They should have always been not just allowed, but encouraged to be back in school. And now, of course, she is the one saying that we're going through a mental health crisis.
Right. And this is a quote that you recently said. The AFT experienced a 2% decline in membership last year because so many educators were upset about how she manipulated the situation for partisan politics. And we are not going to let Randy Weingarten, that's you guys at the Freedom Foundation, get away with rewriting the history of the past 2 years. She needs to pay a price for the damage she caused her school children, as do all the officials who followed her lead and kept the schools shut and kids isolated, staring at screens and not getting the education they need. So the first part of that, I definitely want to dive into the evidence and break down exactly how we know this harmed children, because the evidence is mounting, and I suspect we'll continue to get more and more evidence as these kids who were affected age. I mean, we're talking years and years into the future. I think we're going to be looking at evidence on this point. But I want to get into this question of incentives, which is in your quote. Randy Weingarten, some incentive is what she sensed and flip-flopped on school closures. Why do you think that after going so hard in one direction, she pivoted seemingly without any shame at all? You know, why did she do that and how does she get away with it?
I think she did it because she's finally figured out that the polling of parents and the data that's being presented is that no one really ever agreed with shutting kids out of schools. I think that at the start of the pandemic, there was this very much uncertainty. And I think for a couple of weeks, people were very scared and didn't know what to think. But very quickly, we figured out that COVID was a disease of the elderly and did not affect children. That data was given to us fairly early in the pandemic. But Randy Weingarten failed to recognize that at the start. And she used COVID as a block, as a mechanism to pursue her own political agenda. And she did that, I think the biggest example is in the Los Angeles school districts, where the teachers unions down there basically said that we're not going to go back to school until you defund the police. And they had a shopping list of demands until they would, quote, allow our kids to go back into school. So she was using this to progress her own political agenda, but it backfired. And I think Virginia was probably that moment, what happened in the gubernatorial race there, that showed the world that no, parents and voters and people in general completely disagree with what the teachers union has done the last couple of years.
And then another question of incentives becomes why the union has any incentive to keep Randy Weingarten in her current leadership capacity. It's rather stunning that instead of distancing themselves from her, there's really no, unless I've missed something, reporting that internally people are debating this. It seems as though Randy Weingarten continues to be on MSNBC, continues to be treated as a credible expert by the legacy media, even, you know, as their own reporting goes in different directions now. So what is it that keeps Randy Weingarten, A, at the head of the teachers union, and then B, being treated as a person with any credibility or respect whatsoever in some of these elite spaces?
Well, she's been around for a long time. She's been doing this job for decades now. And I think that people have gotten used to seeing her and elevating her into positions that, frankly, she had no business being in from the very get-go. But the left, of course, loves her because she's a Marxist. I mean, she's basically open about saying that. But the problem with her being the head of the teachers union is that when teachers disagree with the agenda of the teachers unions, and this is something that we do at the Freedom Foundation every day, is they leave their unions, they leave the AFT, they leave all these other government unions, and we actually help them to do that. So the voters or the teachers that remain in her union, those are the ones that they continue to like the agenda that she's advocating for. More and more teachers are definitely becoming divorced with the agenda of the teachers' unions. But those teachers are indeed opting out of their unions. They're saving about $1,100 a year in union dues, and they're opting out. And it's happening at a pretty large level throughout America today.
This gets to that second part of your quote where you see the AFT experienced a 2% decline in membership last year. Can you tell us what we know about the teachers who have walked away from the union since? And then if you have this, exodus of sane, probably politically diverse group of people or politically open-minded group of people leaving the union, on the one hand, I think that probably clearly empowers the union to get even more radical. But on the other hand, they're very much disempowered as their membership shrinks. So can you tell us what that's looked like and what sort of shape is evolving as people walk away?
Sure. So what we do at the Freedom Foundation is we tell government employees and teachers every single day that they can opt out of their union and stop paying union dues. And when they make the decision to do that, they're paying about $1,100 a year. And all they do is fill in a form that we give to them. They send it back to us, we send it to the union, and we have that money stop being deducted from their paychecks. So the people that opt out, they're happier because they get an extra $1,100 a year, which if you're a teacher making $75,000 a year, that's a significant amount of money to put back in your paycheck. So we're seeing this mass exodus through the Freedom Foundation's campaign. But what we're also seeing is a lot of teachers that are doing this organically, teachers that we are not even reaching out to that are finding the website online. They're Googling, how do I opt out of the AFT? And they're finding us and then they're opting out as well. So what we've seen the last year is a net 2% decline in union membership for Randy's union and the other main teachers union, the NEA. And that's the largest decline that we've seen since 2018. Which was the Janus decision that came out of the U.S. Supreme Court. This was the decision that allowed all public employees to opt out of their unions. So I think what you're seeing play out here is the difference between Randy's radical political agenda and your everyday teachers. I mean, you said the politically open-minded. I think, frankly, these teachers and the ones that we speak to, at least, it's not just that they're open-minded. They could be they could be liberal. They could be Republican. Right. They could be, frankly, what we find is most of them just don't care about politics.
Oh, interesting.
What they do care about is their kids, the kids that they're teaching, and they care about their paychecks. And those are the top two reasons that teachers are opting out today.
And two variables that were really interconnected over the course of the pandemic. Obviously, it was the medical safety protocols that schools took to protect students and teachers. And these were, you know, in so many cases, tragically overstepping the necessary bounds. And then on the second hand, we saw this proliferation of very radical social, cultural teaching. Some of it was already there, and then some of it was accelerated in the summer of 2020 by the George Floyd controversy. And so I want to ask Aaron how those two variables interacted in pushing people away from teachers' unions. What are some of the reasons that you saw cited from people who walked away? Because I imagine for a lot of them, it was a combination of both of those things. But I'm curious if you could just tell us maybe what the breakdown looked like, or if there's anything surprising that you heard as people were leaving the union.
So it's no secret that most of the critical race theory and the LGBTQ education indoctrination, we should call it, of our kids is happening in liberal cities and states. And we're seeing most teachers that are opting out come from these liberal cities and states. So that tells you one thing. The other thing we've done is we've done a lot of exposure of what the teachers' unions are actually advocating for in terms of teaching this critical race theory and the likes. And teachers, if you go into the teaching profession today, my wife is a public school teacher, so we know a lot of teachers. if you go into the teaching profession today, you don't go in to teach critical race theory. You don't go in to teach LGBTQ or, you know, that kids are not boys or girls or whatever it may be. You go in to teach math. You go in to teach reading and writing. And you go in, frankly, because you care about kids and you want to educate them. So I'd say 99% of teachers in the workforce today don't really care for teaching any of this. And those aren't the teachers that we're hearing about on TikTok and Facebook and Twitter. So teachers have been getting a bad rap. But it's the 1% of teachers that have been forcing the other 99% to get this bad rap. And I think, again, this is the difference between your everyday teacher and the teachers' unions, who are the loudmouth, obnoxious teachers that are out there advocating for this. And we're definitely seeing that play out in the classrooms. And again, the decline in union membership is another product of what's happening in our schools today.
All right, think about this. Many of us spend more time every day in our office chair than in our cars or in our beds. That's why it's so important to invest in the right chair so that you're spending those hours with the right level of support and comfort so that you can get the most productivity out of your day. When you think about it, we do spend so much time worrying about our mattresses and our cars and not our chairs. But X-Chair has made my time at my desk not only more productive, but it's honestly my favorite place to sit for any reason. So not only does X-Chair's patented dynamic variable lumbar or DVL offer the ultimate customized support, but my X-Chair can even give me a massage or heat up or cool down. And now, thanks to X-Chair's new FS360 armrests, I can even adjust my armrests to the perfect position. Now, all these unique X-Chair features help the hours at my desk fly by in complete comfort. And that's why I love my X-Chair. Go to xchairfederalist.com now. That's the letter X, Chair, Federalist.com, or call 1-844-4X-CHAIR for $100 off your order. X-Chair has a 30-day guarantee of complete comfort, and you can finance your purchase for as little as $30 a month. xchairfederalist.com. Something that really bugs me is every time the left wants to undermine the work of groups like yours, they strip agency away from the workers who actually want to leave the unions themselves. And that also strips culpability away from big labor, and especially from people like Randy Weingarten. I'm saying that as a fairly pro-union person, but in this case, Do you feel like you've coerced all of these teachers, you know, as a sort of a representative of shadowy big business interests? Have you coerced these people, twisted their arms, forced them to walk away? Or do they have, you know, some very legitimate reasons for wanting to save those $1,100? And I'm asking that even before the pandemic. What are the sort of motivations of people who want that? Is it as simple in so many cases as just that $1,100 could be better spent?
Yeah, in most cases it is. It's money that these teachers have earned. It's money that these public employees have earned. It's money that they're entitled to that the unions are taking away from them. I tell people like this, is that if you love your union and you love what they do, then continue to stay with them. Mm-hmm. That's your choice. But a lot of people have no idea that they can leave their unions. And that's why when we go and visit them at their doors or send them mail or whatever it may be, that's why they're opting out in such droves. And the other side to the coin is these teachers' unions, they don't need that money. We just did an expose on the National Education Association.
Yes.
And they are spending hundreds of millions of dollars on politics. This is money that is not representing the teachers. In fact, it's going to support a political agenda that in some cases directly opposes their personal beliefs.
Yeah.
So that's another aspect of what we're seeing play out as well. We would advocate for teachers' unions and other government unions to act like trade associations. If you're going to take money from public employees, spend it on benefits that outweigh the cost of membership. Hmm. That's how every trade association works. And frankly, if a teachers union were to do that, these members wouldn't leave. I mean, they'd have no incentive to. They'd want to be a part of this union.
Right.
But that's not what we're seeing.
Yeah, no. And technically, they aren't supposed to, those funds aren't supposed to be like fungible, I think, right? It's sort of can you explain to us how that works in that? And I know it varies from state to state, but just the basic way that, you know, the American Federation for Teachers and the NEA are funded and what that looks like for individual teachers around the country who have the money taken out of their paychecks.
Yeah, so I'll use an example that we found firsthand. My wife, public school teacher, she used to teach in the Salem Kaiser School District in Oregon, and we got a breakdown from the union when they were trying to entice her to be a union member. And so there's this local president and her right hand person, and they're going around the schools trying to convince teachers to join the union. And she said they seem like very nice people. It seemed like they believe in actually helping teachers and helping students. But when we got the breakdown of where the union dues were being spent, it was about $1,100 a year. And less than $100 was going to this local Salem Kaiser Education Association. Less than $100, less than 10%. The rest of it was going to the National Education Association and the Oregon Education Association. And most of their money, most of their revenue that comes in, gets spent on politics. So, I mean, when we're looking at government unions, what we say is if there's going to be a government union, it should be local only and it should be voluntary. And if that's less than $100 was what was going to be spent on, quote, representational activities, and if someone wants to belong to that, they should be able to belong to just that. They should not be forced to be paying union dues in the hundreds and thousands of dollars to these basically political action committees.
Right. And I was going to ask you, why go after teachers' unions? But I think you just made that point very clear. It's because in so many cases, they are not serving their members and they're, of course, not serving our schools. And I know that this is where you spend the bulk of your work. But I want to ask, this isn't, you know, the sole focus of our podcast. In fact, we should talk about it more. But the question of how unions have particularly undercut the quality of American K through 12 education is a major one and a big one, an important one. What's the best way that you explain the negative effect unions have had on the quality of education students are experiencing K through 12 in the States?
Yeah, so to put it simply, a government union exists. The only reason that they are able to operate is by protecting underperforming employees. This is in any sector. Otherwise, there's no reason for them to exist. So we have to, in the education system in particular, In fact, in any industry, you have the bottom performing employees, whatever it is, in this instance, teachers. And those teachers that are not delivering a service to our kids, they should be fired. And that's an unpopular opinion amongst some people, but if they're not educating our kids and they're not delivering a quality education, why should we as parents settle for that? We shouldn't. There were calls last summer, or maybe it was two summers ago, for defunding the police because of police that were underfunding. And this was coming from the left. But there were no calls for defunding our education system because of underperforming teachers. And I think that gets to the very nexus of the issue, which is that unions exist to protect these underperforming employees. And when they do that, what they're doing is they're actually hurting our kids' education. And the other thing that they do, of course, is advocate against school choice, which, again, is another mechanism for parents to go and take their kids from an underperforming school, or maybe it's an underperforming teacher, and put those kids into other schools. The unions, the teachers' unions, want to monopolize our education system. They've done so pretty successfully so far. And that's one of the reasons that fuels the fire for what we do at the Freedom Foundation.
Yeah, and it seems to me also that just even in an almost indetectably powerful way, or it's difficult to quantify the latitude that public school teachers, and I went to public school K through 12, think that they have in the classroom on a daily basis. And people see this on the Libs of TikTok account, sure, but also in like the quality of the education that they're delivering. It's not just about politics, but I think the latitude just psychologically that teachers take because they know they're so enormously protected by the union and it's difficult to fire them has to play into the drop in quality as well.
Yeah, I mean, us as consumers, and again, in any industry, if we're paying for a service that is not being delivered to our standards, then we stop paying for that service. That's the way capitalism works. Mm-hmm. However, in the public education system, we've dropped the ball here, and we've allowed the teachers' unions to go out and create this system that has monopolized public education and put it under the sphere of government unions. They're now our school districts, our teachers are now at the behest of these big teachers' unions with a big political agenda. And there's no, in states that don't have school choice, at least, there's no other option for our parents. And that is the core, that's at the core of the problem in American education today.
Right. And teachers are not elected, of course. Your school boards are elected and your politicians are elected. But even when, so I'm from Wisconsin, I think about when the Act 10 controversy erupted in 2011, even when voters elect somebody who tries to break up unions, big labor pours tons of money into those races in a way the left would typically be very uncomfortable with if it were coming from, say, the Koch brothers.
Yeah, exactly right. But the scandal of what is happening in that sphere is that this money is being forcibly taken from public employees. The Koch brothers, I mean, yeah, say whatever you want about them, they made their money and they're right, making the decision to do what they want with it. In a lot of instances, these public employees have no idea that their union dues are being spent on politics, and they have no idea that they can opt out either. And there's 7 million public employees across America that pay union dues to four unions. And of course, these are the four biggest political players in America today.
Yeah. And I mean, helping members walk away in and of itself is something that should incentivize the Randy Weingartens of the world to, and it probably did incentivize her decision to flip-flop on school closures, shamelessly flip-flop on school closures. But whether that induces any more change is an open question. And Aaron, I want to shift to the second part of this conversation, which is we are learning some really disturbing details about how those closures affected students. I'm reading from the Harvard Gazette right now. This is a headline: remote learning likely widened racial economic achievement gap. A new report on pandemic learning loss found that high poverty schools both spent more weeks in remote instruction during 2020 to 2021 and suffered large losses in achievement when they did so. Districts that remained largely in person, however, lost relatively little ground. Experts predict the results will foreshadow a widening in measures of the nation's racial and economic achievement gap. Now, that study came from the Center for Education Policy Research at Harvard and the National Center for Analysis of Longitudinal Data in Education Research at the American Institutes for Research now and the NWEA. So, Aaron, I want to ask if that study, and this is a leading question because the answer is yes, but you could speak to why that study confirms what we've seen from other data that's emerged so far over the course of the last year or so. What does this picture look like now that we're able to step back from it a little bit and see the forest from the trees?
Yeah, I mean, it's the first study of what I believe is going to be many to come for decades, frankly. And it says what we knew from the start. What I certainly knew, because I witnessed it happen in my wife's classroom, was that remote learning didn't work. You had logistical problems that were never addressed, especially in low-income communities. You know, if you're in a high-income community or you have the ability to go out and buy multiple laptops, for example, and you have multiple children, they can both be in class at the same time. Or you have the ability to maybe take them into private school where they're doing in-person learning. As a high-income earner, you have the ability to go out and do a lot more than the low-income, impoverished communities. And what we saw was that those low-income, impoverished communities, they were the ones that were being kept out of schools the longest. And these are the kids that needed to be in school. And the education decline, I mean, the ripple down effect is going to be for years to come, and it's going to continue to create this lack of equity across communities. And that's what I think gets to the core of that study, is that we have these liberal ran cities, communities, school districts that were behest to the unions, that were listening to everything they were telling them to do and keeping kids out of schools. And those were the ones that had the largest declines in their education. And again, that's going to be measured in years to come. This is going to be the first of many studies.
To you, this probably seems like an obvious question, but for those of us who don't follow it quite as closely, what was the connection between politics and those low-income districts, and like why they stayed closed as long as they did, relative to the areas, or and maybe it's not neatly by income, maybe it's just that the low-income students in the districts that were closed longer were hit the hardest. Like, what did that breakdown look like in terms of like how this actually trickled into people by their income brackets?
Well, as a generalization, low-income communities are run by Democrats. Mm-hmm. And those Democrat communities are run by unions. Those are the ones that paid for the political campaigns of these Democrats to get into office. So those are the communities that were having schools shut down. The more rural communities, the higher income communities, they're run by conservatives mostly, and they were the ones advocating for getting kids back into school. So that's what's created this large division amongst those two communities, is basically political, which trickles down into the socioeconomic status of these communities as well. And, you know, when you look at these low-income communities, this is where we really need to be supporting education more so than the high-income communities. But the teachers' unions, they went completely against what they said they were advocating for, and they've created now this problem in low-income communities where we have kids that are far behind where they should be. I mean, my wife teaches at a Title I school, which is a low-income community. And the problems that she's seen over the past couple of years, I mean, completely different to before COVID. I mean, not just from an education standpoint, of course, that's what the Harvard study shows, but just by getting kids to attend school, behaviors that she's now seeing in school. Kids, I mean, when they first started to come into school, they viewed it as an option because they hadn't been made to do it for the past couple of years. Mm-hmm. So again, these effects are going to be measured for decades, not just in the immediate.
So I definitely consider my incessant skepticism both a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing in journalism for sure. But as I've watched all of these MyPillow ads over the years, I have just been plagued by the question, are these as good as the commercials say they are? I've always wondered this. And when the fine folks over at MyPillow were kind enough to send me some of their products, I was really pleasantly surprised. These things are great. And right now they're having a BOGO extravaganza. So you can get buy one, get one free pricing on the MyPillow bed sheets as low as $59.98, the Elegance MyPillows as low as $49.98, and that six-piece towel sets. Those are my favorite. Those are included in the BOGO extravaganza. Also the Roll and Go Anywhere MyPillows for $29.98 and so much more. Those six-piece towel sets are made with cotton grown here in the United States. Other towels feel good but don't absorb, or they absorb but they don't feel good. Every MyPillow towel is made from proprietary technology that makes them highly absorbent and soft to the touch. I can confirm that. It's absolutely true. Like I said, these are my favorites. They have no lotion-y feel either. Every set comes with two bath towels, two hand towels, and two washcloths, so you got everything you need. They're available in a variety of colors and sizes, and they are machine washable and come with a 60-day money-back guarantee and a one-year limited warranty. Those roll and go anywhere MyPillows. You can use them on your couch, your recliner, or in your car. They're versatile enough to take on vacation or really anywhere you go. They're also available in multiple colors and patterns and machine washable and dryable for all you parents. That's the most important part. They come with a 10-year warranty and a 60-day money-back guarantee as well. So as you can see, it's a buy one, get one extravaganza over at mypillow.com/Federalist. Bed sheets and MyPillows are just the tip of the iceberg. Find the full list of BOGO offers by visiting mypillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. Stock up with buy one, get one free savings today and get Mike's book free with any purchase. MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. MyPillow.com/Federalist.
One of the reasons the right is particularly opposed to public sector unions, for instance, is that the democratic process, or our Republican system of government, I should say, for all of the people who seem to be confused by that lately, is a mechanism of oversight in and of itself. And we saw an incredible recall in San Francisco of members of the school board. We saw the shock win of Glenn Youngkin in a blue state in Virginia. Do you think that some of these elections have awoken national union leaders or even state union leaders to the harsh reality of the backlash? Or are they so powerful and isolated and kind of congealed in their radicalism that it's difficult to penetrate that bubble no matter what?
Yeah, I think they're so divorced from reality that we're not going to see them change their stance on a lot of things. I mean, of course, Randi has been now saying that we're going through this mental health crisis, but she's merely stating the problem that we have all seen. She's not doing anything about it. In fact, her actions have done just completely the opposite. I think people have awoken. I think parents have woken up to what is happening in our schools, and the Democrats have been the ones that have been enacting this. But I will say this, in some areas, we're starting to actually see Democrats reject the support of the teachers' unions, and I think Virginia was the start to that. I think that teachers' unions are going to continue to go to the left, and the more radical candidates in America are going to go to the left with them. However, we're going to see moderate Democrats start to become divorced from these teachers' unions, and that's going to mean a lot of Democratic primaries that have union-backed radical candidates versus moderate Democrats that are incumbents and have probably been in office for a long time. I think that's going to play out for the next couple of elections, but we'll see. The thing that exposed this to me was Lori Lightfoot. The Chicago teachers' unions was, you know, at the time, this was probably 6 months ago, saying that, you know, we should be keeping our kids out of schools and we should be masking them. Lori Lightfoot said, no, we're going to open them and we're going to get kids back in school. And it was amazing for me to see a radical liberal like Lori Lightfoot and me actually agree on an issue.
Right.
Well, okay, so this is a really important question, and I don't think it's one that gets brought up in the context of this conversation very often, but what role did the media play in facilitating and supporting the teachers' unions in their extremely harmful objective to keep schools locked down? Because the media was terrified to say anything against the grain or heterodox on COVID and on children for a really long time. It kind of reminds me of what happened with the lab leak theory. It took one article in New York Magazine for the media to suddenly dip its toes into the water and say, maybe there's some substance to this and it's not a conspiracy theory and it's not all, you know, crazy people. And I think that happened with school closures. Suddenly they got comfortable criticizing school closures and everyone, it was like a domino effect. But it's really gross when you think about it. And I'm curious from somebody who was working in the space during the time, how much you think the media's silence and in fact, the media's attacks on people who wanted to open schools enabled the teachers unions in their ability to keep schools closed, especially in these low income districts.
Yeah. So my opinion on the media during this whole time of COVID was that they loved it. I mean, they wanted this. They wanted this to continue. Most of the mainstream media, as we know, were adamantly opposed to Trump. And during the election cycle of 2020, I mean, they used it as a mechanism, in my opinion, to try and change who was in the White House. But after that, I mean, think about it this way. They had people in their homes all day. They were fear-mongering. They were reading news outlets online. They were watching CNN or whatever it is and basically soaking it all in about how crazy the world is becoming. Their viewership was probably up significantly during that time frame. So in terms of revenue, they loved COVID. I mean, they had unbelievable viewership during that time frame. So there was no incentive for them to want COVID to go away, mm-hmm. Which I think we have to. I think when we're looking at the media's role in COVID, we have to consider that because they had an incentive for it to continue. And then when stuff started to go back to normal, and you actually saw the consumers of the media wanting their kids to go back in school, wanting to be unmasked, wanting to have places reopened. That's when the media started to shift and then started to challenge what they were reporting on for basically the past 2 years.
Right. And a final question that I think is perplexing, but you said earlier that most teachers love teaching. They want to teach. That was, you know, my experience. And oh, there's so many wonderful people who teach. It sounds like your wife may be one of them. But yes. Why was it that so many teachers wanted to stay home? It seems like so selfish in the face of the evidence. I wonder if partially it was genuine fear because the media did fearmonger so much that you it's hard to even blame people for their just intense fear of going back to work. Was it that they didn't want to speak up and say anything about going back to work because they're afraid they'd be seen as a Trump supporter or anything like that? I mean, what was it that in Chicago, for instance, kept so many teachers adamantly pushing to stay home?
I think you articulated well. I think that part of the problem was that teachers were genuinely scared. And, you know, they were sat at home, they were listening to the teachers' unions and the media that basically put them into a frenzy. And they didn't know what to think of COVID. I mean, you look at polling during COVID in terms of what Republicans thought of COVID and what Democrats thought of it. And Democrats basically during the peak of it basically thought if you got COVID, it was a death. Like you were almost certain to die. And Republicans, the complete opposite, actually, which is mostly true. So I think that you had a lot of polarization happening. And teachers by nature, again, they care for people. They care for kids. And I think that's what fueled a lot of what we saw is that they didn't want kids to get sick. They didn't want themselves to get sick, obviously. But I think that started to change after even a few months, especially in what we would call the flyover states. Because when they started to go back to school after 4 weeks, that was where most of America went back to school, was 4 weeks. I live in a liberal state of Washington. It took us years to go back to school here. But most, when they started to go back to school, they started to realize that this thing wasn't as bad as it was made out to be. They had friends that got COVID. They had friends that got over it. Maybe they got COVID themselves. And that's, I think, what started to reawaken America across that time frame, was that, no, this thing isn't as bad as it was made out to be by the media and the teachers' unions. Yet they were incentivized to continue that crisis.
Mm. Aaron Wythe, CEO of the Freedom Foundation, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me on, Emily.
Of course, this is really great insights. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at The Federalist. We will be back soon with more Federalist Radio Hour. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.